From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, screenwriter and novelist Roddy Doyle. He adapted his novel The Commitments into a hit film about a Dublin band that plays soul music. His new movie, The Snapper, directed by Stephen Frears, is a comedy about a teenager who gets pregnant and won't tell anybody who the father is. Also today, addiction. We talk with Dr. Avram Goldstein about the chemical reasons drugs are addicting, drugs like heroin, cocaine, alcohol, and nicotine. And Maureen Corrigan reviews A Very Long Engagement by French novelist Sébastien Jacquersault. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Clinton will meet Syrian President Hafez al-Assad next month in Geneva. Secretary of State Warren Christopher says the president sees the upcoming meeting as a chance to discuss an Israeli-Syrian peace agreement. Israel and Syria argue over the Golan Heights. The territory was captured by Israel during the Six-Day War in 1967. Syria wants it back and says there will be no peace agreement without the Golan. But both countries will return to the negotiating table early next year. President Clinton is calling on Congress to pass the Comprehensive Crime Bill. He's also talking about putting new controls on weapons. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The president told a group of mayors and chiefs of police that he believes the nation is finally prepared to do something about violent crime and all of its causes.
I think the American people are tired of hurting and tired of feeling insecure and tired of the violence. And it makes such a huge gap between what we say and what we do and how we want to live and how we're forced to live.
Besides getting the final crime bill through Congress next year, the president has ordered his attorney general, Janet Reno, to study a requirement to license all handgun owners. It would require them to prove they can safely handle weapons. According to Reno, such a system would help but not prevent criminals from getting guns. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
The government says that inflation at the producer level was unchanged in November. The government says that energy prices fell, offsetting steep increases for food and new cars. It is the sixth time in 7 months the producer price index has fallen or stayed flat. For the first 11 months of this year, wholesale inflation rose 0.4%. Last year it went up 1.6%. Video game makers are going to label their products for sex and violence before they're forced to by federal law, UBI's Pi Chamberlain reports.
Video game makers decided to try to control themselves before the government controls them. Minutes before a hearing on video game violence, a lawyer for the video game industry, Eileen Rosenthal, said the game makers will soon try
to set guidelines for determining suitable content for children of various ages.
Senators said they were not prepared to buy into any such self-regulation scheme sight unseen and went ahead with their hearing. Pi Chamberlain, Capitol Hill.
The United States and the European Union are still working on the general agreement on tariffs and trade. Negotiators are now arguing over shipping. A senior U.S. official charges European negotiating tactics are threatening to undo the entire trade package, which must be finished by next Wednesday's deadline. European and Japanese officials indicate even if the 116 nations reach an overall agreement, there'll be lots of loose ends left over. On Wall Street, the Dow was down 5 points at 37.29. This is NPR. Russian President Boris Yeltsin doesn't want Eastern European nations to join the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Yeltsin is in Brussels meeting with NATO officials. He told NATO Secretary General Manfred Werner today he is opposed to NATO's expansion eastward. Defense Secretary Les Aspin says he thinks Moscow will eventually soften its opposition to NATO's enlargement. He says NATO is expanding its Partnership for Peace initiative with Eastern European countries and with Russia. This sets up joint peacekeeping projects and crisis management teams. The initiative is expected to be adopted next month by NATO leaders. German authorities are investigating two neo-Nazis who are suspected of publishing a hit list of political enemies. NPR's Deidre Berger reports.
The federal prosecutor's office opened the investigation after raiding the homes of two men in Mainz last night. One of the two operates a right-wing telephone network. Authorities suspect a political hit list that began circulating in Germany last week was put together in part with information called into the neo-Nazi telephone network. One of the two men under investigation is scheduled for trial later this month on charges of distributing illegal Nazi propaganda. Prosecutors will probably expand charges to include the formation of a criminal organization. German authorities are investigating possible connections between the right-wing hit list in Germany, which advocates violence against political opponents, and a series of recent letter bomb explosions in Austria. I'm Dieter Bergen, Frankfurt.
Sarajevo hospital officials say four people died today when three mortar bombs fell on a busy market. Four people were hurt. The mortar rounds fell on the makeshift market in a parking lot surrounded by high-rise apartment buildings. Witnesses say at least 50 people were in the market. Another four people died in Sarajevo today in other incidents. One person was killed by a sniper. The UN says Bosnian Serbs are in the hills surrounding the Bosnian capital. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Remember the popular 1991 film The Commitments? It's a comedy about a young man in Dublin who puts together and manages a band with the mission of bringing classic soul music to Ireland. The screenplay was co-written by my guest Roddy Doyle, who wrote the novel it was based on. Doyle won this year's Booker Prize, Britain's most important literary award, for his new novel Paddy Clark, Ha Ha Ha. His latest movie is opening in the States. It's called The Snapper. Doyle wrote the screenplay and the novel it's based on. The film was directed by Stephen Frears, who also directed My Beautiful Laundrette, The Grifters, and Dangerous Liaisons. Snapper is slang for baby, and the story, which is set in Dublin, is about a teenager who gets pregnant and won't tell anyone who the father is. Some writers might have turned the story into a tragedy. Doyle gives us a family comedy.
Well, I deliberately wanted to emphasize the joyful and the celebratory nature of the pregnancy. And in many ways, I mean, the child's place in or outside of wedlock is irrelevant. You know, a baby is a baby. And I just felt I wanted to celebrate pregnancy per se. I also must admit that although I had a general idea that I was going to write a comic novel when I was sitting down to write it, Sharon, the character herself, in many ways dictated the rest of the book. She's a very strong person, and having got involved herself involved in this rather sordid, unfortunate incident, she makes the most of it and turns, you know, what is a bad accident into an achievement, and drags her family along with her and forces the family and the whole community to accept the baby on her terms rather than on their terms. So I deliberately wanted it to be a book that emphasised the positive, I suppose. If it had been a more middle-class family, I suspect more of the consequences, as you call them, would have come into it, the shame, what will the neighbours think, that type of thing. But the father very quickly, within about 8 minutes of the film starting or less, dismisses what the neighbours think. He doesn't care. He really doesn't care what they think. As for his becoming more and more involved in the pregnancy, that was, you know, as I became more interested in him, he began to take over the book and would have given birth to the child himself if it had been physically possible. But his involvement with the biology of it and his reading every woman and that, I suppose, is a bit of wishful thinking, that there is, you know, a new man living in Dublin.
Yeah, well, actually, there's a very funny scene with that where the father is reading a book about pregnancy, and it's also a book about a woman's body, and he's absolutely fascinated by it and ends up learning new things to do with his wife in bed.
Yes, yeah, he discovers at the age of about 45, he discovers foreplay.
So you said before that you thought that had this family been more of a middle-class family, perhaps the story would have ended up being more about the consequences. So what are the differences that you'd see between a working-class and middle-class family and their reaction to a teenage pregnancy?
Well, I suppose in parts of Dublin, at least one in every three children are born outside marriage. And it's almost habitual, do you know what I mean? So that it happens in every family, or not in every family, but in most families. Everybody knows somebody in the working class areas of Dublin. So it's not a shameful thing in the public sense. It's not a big thing. It's not a shock or a horror. It would have been perhaps 20 years ago, but it certainly isn't now. In middle class areas, the old attitudes, you know, whether it's right or wrong is debatable, but in the middle class areas, the old attitudes die hard, so that pregnancy outside marriage is still a shameful thing, still is something that marks the neighbours. It's something of a stigma, or can be. So that's the general attitude, really. That's the difference between the two. I'm a bit reluctant to go too deeply into it, because when you do make general statements, you're being inaccurate all the time, because there are going to be thousands of individuals who will prove you wrong.
Now, Sharon, the pregnant character in your story, she wouldn't have an abortion because she thinks of that as murder.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, the people in your stories aren't exactly running their lives by the book. I mean, they're not exactly patterning their lives according to what they think the church would like.
No, the church doesn't really enter into any of my books, except in a cosmetic sense in Paddy Clark. No, I think it's an attitude that would be very strong in Ireland. Not necessarily an attitude that's dictated by the church, although that would enter into it. It's just that there is an attitude that people would almost immediately, without even thinking about it, dismiss abortion in any circumstances as murder. Bearing in mind that the book was written about 4 years ago, attitudes, I think, since various sex abuse cases have come up here in Ireland, and there have been constitutional considerations. Attitudes have become a bit more flexible since then. But when I was writing the book, I've no doubt whatsoever that the vast majority of women in Sharon's position would have just said it's, particularly of her class, would have said it's murder, and wouldn't have delved deeper into the possibility of having an abortion.
Is there good access to birth control in Dublin?
There is, yes. I could say that now, but if you'd asked me the question 5 years ago, I'd have said there isn't, no.
What's
but
changed?
Times have changed. Availability, basically, public knowledge. There are now advertising hoardings all over the place pleading with people to use condoms, whereas in the past, the advertising hoardings, although they weren't used, would have been used to plead with people never to get into a position where they had to use condoms. Attitudes have changed somewhat.
Mm-hmm. Your previous film, The Commitments, did very well in the United States, and the character is the family is basically the same family, although the name has been changed in the new film. And in The Commitments, the oldest son wants to live the life of rock and roll, so he wants to put together a rock and roll band and manage them, which he does, and that's what the film's about. There's a lot of musical references in your work. Has music always been very important to you? Are you somebody who's, especially when you were young, defined yourself by your musical taste?
Yeah, certainly when I was a teenager, I often determined my friends according to what they listened to, you know. And now music is still quite important to me. I'll often hear a piece of music and, like a lot of people, I know exactly what I was doing the first time I heard that. Or these days I often will force the issue by when my children were born, the day after, if I had free time, I'd go into a music store and buy some new piece of music just so I could associate the music with the births, you know. So music is quite important to me. But I just find that it's all over the place anyway, and I just wanted my books to reflect that. I mean, you can't enter a supermarket or turn on, you know, go into a house or anything at all, but you're hearing snatches of music. And one of the disturbing things I find more recent trends is how advertising has kidnapped all the best rock and roll songs and used them to their own purpose. And that means that we hear even more music, you know. So it's just all pervasive. It's all around us. So characters in my books tend to just break out into song all the time, sometimes, you know, appropriately, sometimes just for the heck of it.
In the home of the family in The Commitments, at least in the movie, there's two pictures on the wall. One is the Pope, and above that is Elvis Presley. Are rock and roll and religion the twin deities?
Oh, yeah. Well, Elvis is God, and the Pope is God's anointed. No, I think the Pope thing needs a little bit of explanation. The Pope was here. He paid a visit here in 1979. And virtually every house in Ireland ended up with a picture of the Pope or something, some, you know, relic, or not a relic, but some souvenir of the Pope's visit hanging up on the wall or on the mantelpiece or something or other. That's why I'm inclined when I'm describing rooms or that, there's always something about the Pope there. The problem with that, and I think I might drop it after a while, is that it's seen inaccurately. It's seen as being the all-pervasive influence of the church or whatever, or the Pope looking down on the family. But it just happens to be, it was a huge event in Ireland in September 1979, and it left its, if you like, physical mark on all the houses in the country. So that's why the Pope is always up on the wall. Elvis is a huge, huge semi-god in Dublin. Elvis and, you know, one or two footballers are, in the male world, the big people to look up to. Despite all the evidence to the contrary.
Are there Elvis impersonators in Dublin?
Virtually every working class estate in Dublin would have at least one Elvis impersonator, yeah. And you don't have to actually spend too long. You can see them coming along the way. They're still, despite most of them are in their early 60s, they still try best to look like... And they all, unfortunately, I'd be a big fan of Elvis's 50s recordings, but they all try to... in appearance, tried to capture the Las Vegas look, you know, which is probably easier for them, actually, you know.
Right, because they've put on a few pounds over the years anyways.
Exactly.
Were you ever in a band yourself?
I was never in a band. I never managed a band. I can't play an instrument and I can't sing.
But you probably wish you could do all of the above.
I wish, and I still wish I could do all of the above. Yeah, no, I couldn't be bothered managing a band. That wouldn't be in me. No, but I'd love to be in a band, all right. But I never will be. I'm able to fantasize and realize the limits of my talents at the same time.
I know you taught for many years. Did you have a lot of students who were in bands and who had the ambition of really making it?
Yes, and for years, yes, there was a spell, and it may well be there as well, I'm a bit out of touch now, but there was a spell when, one-third of the people I thought were in bands or just about to join bands or just had been flung out of bands. At one stage, Dublin just seemed to have more bands than any other activity, you know, probably the influence of U2.
Right, they made it, so I can too.
Yes, yeah, unfortunately, not many of them have, unfortunately. It's a huge, big cloud, U2. I don't blame them at all, but it's almost a burden that Dublin has had to bear. It's not their fault, it's probably Dublin's fault, but constantly if a band bring out a new single or a good single and it gets to number 97 in the British charts, they are immediately branded the new U2 and then explode and disappear without trace.
Now, you recently gave up teaching after... what, 14 or 15 years, I believe?
14 years, yes.
Yeah, what made you decide to give it up? In previous interviews, you'd always said that so much of your inspiration and your material came from teaching and watching your students.
Yeah, well, I suppose, you know, simply I changed my mind. there was two reasons, really. The first was that I had always had a lot of free time to write. I had never had any problem incorporating the two jobs. I could be home at 4:30. My wife usually finished work at about 6:30. So I'd do a couple of hours' work writing, and that was enough for me. And the holidays here for teachers are very generous, so that combination kept me going. But when the children arrived, I've now two very young kids, that free time began to dwindle away. And it's really, I still, by the time they were in bed and we had the house cleaned up, it might be touching 9 o'clock or thereabouts, and I'd go into the room for another hour, maybe an hour and a half, and that was fine. I could still do a bit of work, but at a cost. There was nothing else to my life, you know, or, you know, to our life. So really, I just decided that one of the jobs had to go. And, you know, in the interim, teaching had become less important to me. I suppose because my own children were in the house, I became a good deal less fascinated with other people's. And on top of that, the repetitive nature of the job, the reading the same texts and imparting the same information just began to wear me down after a while. But it wasn't until I made up my mind one day in September of last year. And I sort of, within the space of a couple of days, went from liking the job to actually disliking it an awful lot very, very quickly. I suppose because I'd made my mind up.
So what did you start to dislike once your mind changed?
Oh, the sheer, like reading Lord of the Flies for about the 57th time. It's a great, great book, but, you know, I've only read my own books once. And here I was yet again reading about Piggy. And, you know, I almost cheered when Piggy's head hit that stone and it smashed. That was good. at least in the realization that I'd never have to read it again, you know. And it's not the book's fault. It's a wonderful book. But I was also, I constantly mention it because it almost makes me nauseous to mention some of the other books. Like I read Emma by Jane Austen to kids who could not give a toss about Emma or Jane Austen about once a year, you know. And I hated the book from the word go, even when I was reading it as a student in university, when there were no strings attached, if you like. And I hate it even more now. So I had to force myself through it, really, taking anti-nausea tablets for the last couple of months of the school year.
My guest is Roddy Doyle. He wrote the novels The Commitments and The Snapper and adapted both of them into films. He also won the 1993 Booker Award in England, the Britain's most prestigious literary award. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. Writer Roddy Doyle is my guest. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in a place called Kilbarrick on the north side of Dublin, about 4 miles out from the city centre.
Mm-hmm. Now, you have a new novel that I assume is semi-autobiographical. It's called Paddy Clark, Ha Ha Ha, and it just won the Booker Prize, the most prestigious literary prize in the UK. What got you thinking about childhood? Your previous fiction has been about people who are older than that.
Yeah, well, it's not autobiographical or semi-autobiographical, although the background and the geography are my own. The story isn't mine. Well, what I wanted to do after I'd finished writing The Van, my third novel, was to write something completely different, just for the heck of it, to see if I could. I thought The Van would be a much better book if there were no further installments of The Rabbit Family. And having written three books that I think are quite separate, but in broad ways similar, I wanted to just test myself to see if I could do something that was entirely different to the previous ones. So I decided I'd write from the point of view of a child, and see if a 10-year-old child, and see if I could really get into his head and capture the way he spoke and his own logic and the type of personality he was. And I also decided to set it in the past, because dialogue comes quite easy to me. And I wanted to really just test myself again to see if I could capture the way people spoke in 1968. Now, I, you know, was 10 in 1968. I don't remember what people spoke like. So I just wanted to, you know, use my imagination and just see if I could do it. And if I couldn't, I'd dump it and do something else instead. But what really got it going, the book going emotionally, was the birth of my elder son, Rory. Within minutes of him being born, I had this rush of memories from my past, which I hadn't given my past much thought at all. And I suppose, anticipating his future, I was recalling my past. And they sparked off the whole thing. I began to list down names of television programs that I watched as a kid, and they sparked off memories. And those memories, in consequence, sparked off other memories. Now, I don't trust memory. I think we remember lots of things happening to us which never did actually occur, but it didn't matter. Mm-hmm. And I rejected most of the memories and created fictional scenes out of some other ones. So that's where the whole idea came from.
In thinking back to your childhood, I'm wondering if you saw your family life as tragedy or comedy or something in between. And I ask that because in for instance, The Snapper, you take a situation that some people would consider tragic and you make it a comedy.
Yeah, well, my own upbringing was actually, looking back on it now, was very, very happy. I don't recall my parents ever fighting in my company. It wasn't a very full house, in the sense that, you know, by Irish standards at the time, it wasn't that big a family. There were two parents and four children. But it was a very full house, in the sense it was a very active house. My father was unlike a lot of fathers of that generation, you know, the fathers who sit in a corner and don't want to be disturbed. He was a very flamboyant man, still is in many ways. You know, he's always a flamboyant dresser. He's always singing, played the banjo, played the piano, inflicted the banjo on us every day. My mother also was a very funny woman. My father was very witty. My mother was also very, very funny, a great mimic in a quieter sort of a way. So the house was always very, very, very light, very happy. And it was just looking back from an adult's perspective that my parents made an awful lot of sacrifices to make it that way. Obviously, I didn't appreciate it at the time. It just happened. It came with the house. But I look back on it now with a great deal of affection and gratitude. So the darker moments in Paddy Clark, for example, aren't, I'm glad to say, my moments.
You've written four novels, right?
Yes.
Did I count right?
You did, yeah.
And the first one was The Commitments, which you published yourself back in 1987. What made you think that this is the direction you should head in? You should publish this yourself.
Well, I got into the habit of writing from around about 1982. I had done one or two satirical articles for university papers when I was there, but I wouldn't consider that part of the writing habit. I just wrote them on a whim very quickly and handed them over, and some of them were published. And then I gave up for some years. I didn't do any writing at all as I got into the role of being a teacher. But in 1982, I remember during the summer holidays, and we get 3 months holidays here, I gradually got into the habit of sitting down for a while every day and writing. I spent about 4 years writing what I now know is a dreadful novel, and sent it off to all the Irish publishers and then all the British ones at enormous expense. It was a huge thing, about the weight of a couple of house bricks, and cost a fortune to send all over, you know, the British Isles. And what struck me as being quite bad was that I think only about two of them actually took any interest in reading the novel itself or even a synopsis of it. The rest just dismissed it completely. They had no interest in knowing about it because it wasn't coming through an agent. I didn't have an agent, and it struck me, I approached a few and they didn't want me because I hadn't been published, and it struck me as being sort of not only one gate locked, but both gates were locked. You couldn't be published without an agent. You couldn't get an agent unless you'd been published. So I wrote the commitments very, very quickly, and I felt very good about the commitments, and it began to dawn on me that the other thing I'd done over 4 years was a piece of nonsense. But I felt that the commitments was a bit different and a bit fresher, and I decided to did a bit of investigating with a friend of mine here called John Sutton, and we found out that it wasn't all that expensive to print and publish the book. That I could do it with the same amount of money that I'd have gone to the bank looking for if I was buying a second-hand car. So that's what we did in 1987. Rather than, you know, send it off to the publishers again and wait for all the rejection slips, I decided just to do it myself.
And how often self-published books don't really get noticed. They don't get reviewed as much. They don't get distributed as well in bookstores. How did your book get noticed?
Well, luckily in Ireland, the papers are more open, the newspapers are more open to that type of project. You still get that old snobbery in some of the British papers where they'll only review hardback books, you know. So, but that wasn't the case in Ireland, and hasn't been, and still isn't the case, where any book that arrives on the desk of the literary editors in some of the, not all, but some of the Irish papers is going to get reviewed. It may appear sort of some months after you want it to, but in the case of the commitments, I think because it had a good cover, for one thing. It was an immediately striking cover. And I remember we spent a lot of time on the press release and wrote this outrageous press release. I can't actually remember what was in it, but I know it annoyed a few people. So it gathered a lot more attention than it would have done normally, because it was vanity publishing, really, when you look at it. Mm-hmm. But it was reviewed by a lot of the papers, and some of them favourably, and a lot of them quite hostilely. But what was quite apparent was that there was nobody was indifferent about the book. They either loved it or hated it, and that, I think, generated interest as well, and it became something of a cult book before it was published in Britain.
You've said that because of the success of U2, whenever an Irish rock band puts out a new record, if it's good, it's always called, oh, the next U2. Do you think you're going to have the same effect on literature, that now people are going to be, oh, the next Roddy Doyle? And how would you feel about that?
Well, I certainly hope not. One of the criticisms of my work in Ireland has been that it's so easy, anybody could do it. Look at it on paper. Anybody could do that. Despite the evidence, nobody else has done it so far, you know. So it may well be that people would start writing in the same style I do, perhaps, you know, in simple English with a lot of dialogue or whatever the other ingredients of my work are. But so far there hasn't been a huge invasion of these people into the literary world. But comparisons are inevitable. I mean, reviewers will always, for convenience sake, will always compare somebody's work to another person's. And I suppose because I have won the Booker Prize, and because my books have been very successful here and in Britain and Canada and other places, that the comparisons are almost inevitable. But I wouldn't take them too seriously. I don't think I'd find them irritating, really.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Roddy Doyle's new film is called The Snapper. His new novel is called Patty Clark, Ha Ha Ha. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. A recent study blames substance abuse for 500,000 American deaths a year. That includes cigarettes, alcohol, and illegal drugs. Coming up, we talk with Dr. Avram Goldstein about how drugs affect the nervous system. He's a professor emeritus of pharmacology at Stanford University, and he's conducted drug research and organized the first major methadone clinic in California. And Maureen Corrigan reviews a new French novel about World War I, which has just been translated into English. It's called A Very Long Engagement. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Delaware Supreme Court has upheld a lower court's decision in favor of QVC's hostile takeover bid for Paramount Communications. Paramount had launched a number of anti-takeover defenses against QVC. Paramount's board of directors wants to work out a deal to merge with Viacom, QVC's rival. A former Atlanta branch manager of an Italian bank that was implicated in arms sales to Iraq has been sentenced to prison. Christopher DeGruel, the Atlanta manager of the Italian Banca Nazionale del Lavoro, was ordered to spend 37 months in prison. He was convicted of granting more than $4 billion in illegal loans to Iraq during the Iran-Iraq War of the 1980s. President Clinton met with several mayors and chiefs of police from big cities today at the White House. They discussed the nation's reaction to violent crime. President Clinton says the country must consider strong new ways to fight the problem. He called on Congress to pass a comprehensive crime bill.
This is the first step, but only the first step we have to take in restoring the conditions of civilized life to a lot of our cities. The reason a lot of these things are happening is that there has been a simultaneous decline of work, family, and community, the things that really organize life for all the rest of us. And we are going to have to rebuild them all.
The president says the administration will consider steps like handgun licensing and a national collection of illegal weapons. Dr. Jack Kevorkian is in the 10th day of a hunger strike. His attorney says the euthanasia advocate's health is deteriorating. Don Gagne reports from Detroit.
Kevorkian has not eaten any solid food since being jailed last week for allegedly violating Michigan's law banning assisted suicide. He has also refused to pay a $50,000 bond. Jail officials say they will transfer Kevorkian to a hospital before allowing him to starve himself to death, but Kevorkian has refused to allow doctors to examine him. Now, however, his attorney, Jeffrey Feiger, says he is concerned that Kevorkian does not have long to live and has agreed to let two doctors look at him tomorrow. One of the physicians will be selected by the jail, the other by Feiger. Yesterday, a videotape of Kevorkian was released. Seated in a wheelchair and wrapped in a blanket, he was gaunt, unshaven, and appeared weak. His critics say it's all an act. For National Public Radio, this is Don Gagne in Detroit.
Authorities in the occupied territories are reporting more violence. Villagers in the West Bank say an Israeli gunman shot and killed a Palestinian farmer who was plowing his field. A Jewish settler was wounded in a knife attack in Gaza. The bloodshed comes in the middle of a general strike. Strikers are observing the 6th anniversary of the Intifada, the Palestinian uprising. On Wall Street, stocks closed lower today. The Dow lost nearly 5 points to end at 3,729. Trading was heavy. This is NPR. The State Department says 81 Haitians who came to the United States by boat will be sent back to Haiti. The group was picked up off the coast of Cuba by the Coast Guard. This will be the second repatriation in 3 days. Human rights activists say there may be a new wave of boat people from Haiti after reports of increased repression in many parts of that country. Nearly 40,000 Haitians fled their country after September 1991. That's when President Jean-Bertrand Aristide was toppled from power. In May 1992, the U.S. government ordered all Haitian refugees to be returned to Haiti. The government of Ivory Coast stepped down today. The resignation follows the death of the country's longtime president 2 days ago. Cindy Shiner of Africa News Service reports from the Ivorian capital, Abidjan.
Prime Minister Alassane Ouattara and his government formally handed over power today to Henri Konan Bédié, who has the constitutional mandate to become president. For the past 2 days, a power struggle appeared to be brewing. It was unclear who would emerge as the leader following the death of Africa's longest ruling head of state, Félix Houphouët-Boigny. Ouattara refused to recognize Bédié as Ivory Coast's ruler. Bédié, who immediately received the backing of former colonial ruler France, takes on a difficult job. He has to fill the shoes of Houphouët-Boigny. He was one of post-colonial Africa's founding fathers who helped lead Ivory Coast to relative prosperity in the 1980s. But Bédié inherits a nation in economic decline that has tasted little of the political rivalry seen in turbulent neighboring countries. For National Public Radio, I'm Cindy Shiner in Abidjan.
The nation's health maintenance organizations are increasing their business. A trade group says 45 million Americans are enrolled in the prepaid health plans and another 5 million are expected to sign up next year. The Group Health Association of America says HMOs raised their rates a little more than 8% just this year. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Yesterday, Surgeon General Joycelyn Elders created quite a stir when she suggested the government should investigate whether legalizing drugs could reduce violent crime. What isn't controversial is the fact that drugs are killing Americans and are at the heart of our crime problem. Why are drugs addictive? A few days ago, I spoke with Dr. Avram Goldstein, author of the new book Addiction, From Biology to Drug Policy. Goldstein is a pharmacologist, neurobiologist, and physician. He's conducted important clinical research and in 1969 organized the first major methadone clinic in California. He's a professor emeritus of pharmacology at Stanford University. He writes that we make artificial distinctions between legal and illegal addictive drugs.
I mean primarily that when you look at addiction as a general problem and as a disease, I hope we get to talk about that, that there's absolutely no difference between the drugs that happen to be legal in our society and the drugs that have heavy restrictions on them. So these artificial distinctions come from a long history of trying to make it seem that nicotine and alcohol are really not drugs. And in fact, you often hear people say alcohol and drugs, or smoking and drugs. That's nonsense from the standpoint of a physician and scientist looking at the problem.
Let's start with some basic science, if we could. And I'll ask you to keep this as simple as possible, because science is a little hard to follow on the radio. But could you give us a very basic explanation about why opiates give pleasure to the person who's using them?
Yeah, I'll try to do that. But it's not just opiates. What I have to say applies again to all seven families of addictive drugs. Inside of our brains, there is a special system of nerve cells, a special pathway, which we call the reward pathway. We know how it works. We know what brain chemicals are involved in it. And stimulation of that pathway produces pleasure. It does so in animals. It does so in people. And that's the central point about all the addictive drugs. Excessive stimulation of that pathway, which of course has a normal role also, excessive stimulation of that pathway is harmful.
So addictive drugs artificially stimulate these pleasure pathways.
Exactly. Artificially is the key. Those pathways are there for a purpose, of course. They've been developed over the whole course of evolution, over millions of years. And the purpose of them is to see that animals and now people do the right things. So it's the same pathway that says I'm hungry and is satisfied when I eat. It says I'm thirsty and satisfied when I drink. It's the same pathway that mediates sexual pleasure because sex is important to the survival of the species. It's the overstimulation artificially. I call it in my book the short-circuiting of that normal pathway that gets into real trouble.
There is a theory that some people who become addicted to drugs are medicating themselves for deficiencies. For instance, you say some heroin addicts say that the first time they shot up heroin, they felt right for the very first time. What can you elaborate on that theory that some people might be using addictive drugs to compensate for certain chemical deficiencies in their system?
Well, I think the thing that drives that conclusion more than anything else is the experience with the methadone maintenance of heroin addicts. Now, methadone is a drug very much like heroin. It's an opiate drug. It acts in the same place. It has a big difference from heroin in that it has a long duration of action, and so a person can have a stable level of methadone for a long time. Now, methadone treatment of heroin addiction has been in use now for about 25 years. So there's a lot of experience with it. The experience shows that the people who do best, the heroin addicts who do best on methadone, are the people who stay on methadone, who don't try to get off methadone. And those people are not getting high on methadone. Somehow it is stabilizing their emotional state, stabilizing their feeling of normality and satisfaction, and they're able to function, and they're able to hold jobs, and they're able to do education, and so on. That's pretty impressive evidence, and it suggests that those people may have some kind of deficiency in their normal opiate system, which we call the endorphin system in the brain. Now, this deficiency has never been demonstrated. Of course, you can't go into human brains easily to find out if that's true or not. If it could be shown that it's true, it would make a very big difference in the way society looks at the problem of heroin addiction. But it is a theory that merits a lot more research, and a lot of work is being done to try to see if it's true or not.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Avram Goldstein, and he's a professor emeritus of pharmacology at Stanford University. He also created California's first methadone clinic. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Dr. Avram Goldstein is my guest. He's professor emeritus of pharmacology at Stanford University and author of the new book, Addiction, From Biology to Drug Policy. Let's talk a little bit about the medical and legal implications of the latest research into addictive drugs. Why don't we start with medical implications? Based on all the research you've done over the years about addictive drugs, do you think that we should be emphasizing a more medical approach to drug addiction than we are now?
The answer to that is very simple. I think that addiction is a disease. It's a disease the cause of which we don't fully understand, and there are many diseases like that. To me, that means that it should be treated as a disease. That means it's a public health problem. It's not primarily a problem that should be dealt with by the criminal law. That means a shift in our emphasis toward the problem. In the case of alcohol addiction, that shift really has taken place over the last 25 years or so. Now people generally accept that alcoholism is a disease, and that affects the way one thinks about it and the way one deals with it. That change hasn't yet taken place with respect to certain of the other addictive drugs, particularly cocaine and heroin. So I think that is an important shift in public perception with implications for public policy.
So in your ideal world, if you were planning it, if somebody was using and they were discovered by a law enforcement officer. Do you think that person should be arrested or be put into some compulsory treatment center, or is there another alternative you'd recommend?
Well, that's difficult to answer because that depends, again, on the particular drug. I think that the policies have to be fashioned specifically for each of the addictive drugs because the problems they present are entirely different. But in general, I think that it's important that treatment be universally available. Anyone who recognizes their problem or their family recognizes the problem should be able to get that person into treatment with no red tape, with no impediments, no barriers. And when they fall out of treatment, that is, they fall by the wayside, which is what happens very frequently, they should be admitted to treatment again and again and again. This is a relapsing kind of disease. And it's very strange that other relapsing diseases that we in the medical profession deal with, let's say rheumatoid arthritis, when a person relapses, gets worse despite your best efforts, you don't kick them out of treatment. You intensify your efforts to find the best way of treating them, and you expect relapses to occur. Well, addictions are like that. Relapses occur. Eventually, many people are able to give the whole thing up and lead a normal life. Many people have difficulty ever getting to that stage. You only have to look at the people you know who are nicotine addicts to see what I'm talking about. A third of the people who ever smoked have quit smoking, so people can give it up. On the other hand, there's a hardcore. They know all about it. They know it's harmful. Everybody is badgering them to quit smoking. They know it's going to kill them. They can't stop smoking. Nothing more pathetic than a person in a hospital bed after having a lung removed because of lung cancer, and they wanted their pack of cigarettes. So you have to be sympathetic to that. This is a behavioral disorder, a behavioral disease, and needs to be treated that way.
Do you think that any of the addictive drugs that are now illegal should either be legalized or have their use decriminalized?
Let me say, first of all, that that the term legalized has to be defined. What are we talking about? Very few, if any, people would want to make all addictive drugs available in the local supermarket for all people of all ages to buy. Very few people would do that. And if you don't do that, then you're going to regulate every one of those drugs in some way, and there's going to be greater and lesser degrees of regulation. That's what has to be discussed. Is the level of regulation correct for each of the drugs? For example, one way to regulate access to drugs and to affect the use pattern is to adjust the cost of drugs through taxation. So if you put a heavy cigarette tax on, for example, that's a way of reducing the nicotine addiction problem. It's a regulatory procedure. If you, to some extent, decriminalized marijuana use, because marijuana is probably the least harmful of the addictive drugs, or one might say next to caffeine, probably the least harmful, although we don't have all the evidence in. Well, if one wanted to do some kind of decriminalization of that particular drug, there are a number of ways that it could be done. So the general issue of legalization, in quotation marks, I don't buy that way of approaching the problem. Question is, what degree of regulation do we want for each of these drugs that will optimize? That is to say, that will reduce the use of the drug as much as possible, but not to the extent of criminalizing the user. And there's some optimal level. It's a compromise. It won't be perfect, but some level for each of those drugs. I personally don't think that cocaine or heroin should in any way be legalized. I think that they are both dangerous drugs and that the present prohibition has in fact been responsible for keeping down the usage to the point where it is a relatively minor problem compared with addiction to nicotine and to alcohol.
You opened the first methadone clinic in California. A lot of people say that methadone is an almost foolish way of treating heroin addiction because at best you're substituting one addiction, heroin, for another, methadone. Do you think that that's a legitimate criticism? And if you could give us a kind of brief summary of what your experiences with methadone as a treatment for heroin have been.
Well, I think the way you deal with that question is to ask, what outcome are you interested in? If you're interested in the rehabilitation of the addicts in their normal function, in their feeling normal in every way, then you can accomplish that by long-term maintenance on methadone. Now, nobody says that when you give insulin to a diabetic, you're doing something terrible because they have to be on insulin the rest of their lives and you're just substituting one bad thing for another. You don't hear that. But we hear it about methadone. And to me, it just makes no sense. You look at the outcome, and it's been clearly established that people on methadone, provided they're getting an adequate dosage of methadone, provided they're getting adequate additional services in a well-run clinic, those people do very well functionally. They function as productive citizens, and that's what we're looking for.
Dr. Goldstein, if you could change one popular misconception about addictive drugs, what would it be?
It's a good question. I guess that the most important one that I would try to change would be the notion that alcohol and nicotine are in some way different from all the rest. That's a major social problem that we have, that mythology about those two drugs.
That they're not as harmful, do you mean? What's the similarity?
The fact is they're more harmful, but the popular conception that there's something different about them. They're not as bad somehow as the illicit addictive drugs. They're worse.
Dr. Avram Goldstein is the author of the new book Addiction, From Biology to Drug Policy. He's a professor emeritus at Stanford University. This is Fresh Air.
I'm Linda Wertheimer. Later today on All Things Considered, we will have some pieces from New York on the shooting on the Long Island Railroad. What happened, who the man is who did the shooting. Nina Totenberg is covering a story at the Supreme Court. Abortion clinics are attempting to sue anti-abortion demonstrators under the racketeering statutes. The Supreme Court has to rule on whether or not that can happen. The religious right is attempting to recruit minorities into the fold, and Lynn Neary will have a piece on that. Mike Schuster is covering the Russian elections. The Russian people are going to vote on the Constitution and on the parliament. That is all on All Things Considered later today from National Public Radio.
Sebastian Yaprusso's novel about World War I, called A Very Long Engagement, became an immediate bestseller in France when it was published there in 1991. It's just been translated into English, and critic Maureen Corrigan warns that once you start reading it, you'd better be prepared to cancel all other plans for the next couple of days.
In Milan Kundera's novel, The Unbearable Lightness of Being, there's a scene at a cocktail party where a woman lectures to her fellow guests about the two categories of literature. She says, "There are books meant for daytime reading and books that can be read only at night." I recalled that scene almost as soon as I began A Very Long Engagement. This is, without a doubt, the kind of pensive, heartbreaking book you should save for a sleepless night, when the only distractions will be the sound of your own breathing and, most probably, the solitary embarrassment of a few tears. Sebastien Yaprusso's novel is a murder mystery, a fierce love story, and a vivid portrait of France during and after World War I. Its atmosphere is gothic and dreamy, all quiet on the Western Front crossed with Wuthering Heights. The story opens on the snowy evening of January 6, 1917. French soldiers are marching five of their own men, prisoners, through the trenches. These men have been condemned for trying to invalid themselves out of the war by shooting their own hands. At the end of the last trench, the prisoners are thrown over the top into no man's land. We learn the former civilian identities of the five men as they disappear into the night. There's a carpenter nicknamed the Eskimo, a radical trade unionist, a taciturn farmer known only as That Man, a pimp named Angel, and a shell-shocked 19-year-old named Manek. By the following morning, their five corpses will lie scattered over the wasteland, and that should be the end of the whole shameful episode. But Manek's fiance, a 17-year-old named Mathilde, won't rest until she satisfies her agonizing curiosity about his exact fate. Here's how Yaprisseau lyrically describes Mathilde's quest for the truth. A wire snaked its way through all the trenches. Mathilde has seized hold of it. It guides her into the labyrinth from which Manek has not returned. She never loses heart. She tells herself that if this wire does not lead her back to her lover, that's all right. She can always use it to hang herself. Mathilde is an astonishing creation. She's cunning and bossy, and although she's been confined to a wheelchair since childhood, she travels all over France to interview comrades and relatives of the dead men. Through letters, lies, and flashbacks, Yaprisseau gives distinctive voices here to a battalion of characters. He's also adept at slow-motion suspense. In the early months of Mathilde's investigation, she learns the five soldiers lived for hours during that night in no man's land. Manek even built a snowman out there. Over the next few years, she collects odd clues about their deaths: a pair of boots, a lost glove, encoded letters. And as her search draws to a close, Mathilde crosses into the twilight world of the dead to learn the truth from a soul in torment. If that's too metaphorical a plot summary for you, the plain English explanation is, I don't want to give away the surprise ending. The usual compliment to pay a great novel is to say, I couldn't put it down. But a very long engagement was so terribly moving, sometimes I just had to.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed A Very Long Engagement by Sébastien Yaprisseau, that's spelled J-A-P-R-I-S-O-T. Fresh Air's senior producer this week is Fred Landerl. Our engineers are Joyce Lieberman, Audrey Voblaitis, and Chris Fraley. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from the Vanguard Group of Investment Companies, with 74 mutual fund portfolios offering comprehensive investment and retirement services, 1-800-643-3395. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Why do some teenagers deal drugs or carry guns? On the next Fresh Air, we'll ask two young men who grew up in violent neighborhoods and are now trying to steer clear of trouble. We'll also meet Mary Previty, superintendent of the Camden County Youth Detention Center. Her program helped them on their way. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.